We have this funny idea. This idea that you can divide the room, you know, on the right-hand side is the physical, and on the left-hand side is the spiritual. But before you send me any mail, I know that it's all one. I'm just doing this because I happen to still be in the physical plane. And we need duality in order to understand from the perspective of the ego. But my inner knowing is that there's no separation of spirit and matter. That God is in all things. And that there is individualized expressions of it. But that this intelligence doesn't ever particularize. It can't. That would mean that there's some place that it isn't the minute that it particularizes. And if it's universal, there can never be any place that it isn't. That's what universal means. One verse. So we have this myth that we live under that says we come into this world. And we really sort of think of ourselves as like a construction project. You know, like there's the spirit world. And we divide it up into befores and afters. So I'm here, but before I was here, I was nowhere. And then I went from nowhere, N-O-W-H-E-R-E, to now here, N-O-W-H-E-R-E, just a little different spacing. And now I'm in now here, and I look around, and after a while I have this thundering realization that I'm going back to nowhere, and then it's all the same. But somehow our intellect, our left brain, tells us we come from a spirit world, and then we come into this physical world, and then when we leave it and we die, we go back to a spirit world. Isn't that what we think? It's not like that at all. We have to shatter that myth. Here's the way to think of it. It's like, think of a plum tree. Plum tree has very interesting characteristics of it. Again, you go back to the seed, you know the seed inside of a plum. Is there plum essence in a plum seed? Is the essence of plumness in a plum seed? Has to be, doesn't it? So you put the seed into the ground and you plant it, and all of a sudden it starts breaking open and roots develop and they go under the ground. Is there plum essence in the roots? Isn't there? There has to be, doesn't there? Something in there is going to create plums. And then those roots grow and spread, and all of a sudden a tree starts sprouting up above the surface. And there's a trunk. Is there plum essence in the trunk? Yeah. And then the trunk gets higher, and there are branches. And then the branches develop leaves. And then the leaves develop blossoms. And then the blossoms develop little buds. And then the little buds turn into little tiny plums. And then you let them stay on there for a while, and then they turn into purple plums or green plums or whatever their essence is. Now, we don't say when we observe this phenomenon that these plums showed up from the spirit essence world of plumness. Do we? We don't do that. We just look at the tree and we observe it and we watch the whole thing and we realize that plum essence is in all of the thing, and we stand back and we watch it and we say, you know, the damn thing just plums. It just plums, like an apple tree. It just apples. So too are we like this. We are not separate from that spirit world. That separation is the thing we got to get out of us. It's like someone could come back and look at the whole planet and say there's vegetation, there's rocks, there's minerals, there's rain, there's sunshine. Look at this thing from a distance. Look at it. Just watch it. And what happens? You watch it and you watch it and you watch it, and the damn thing just peoples. It just peoples. That's the way Alan Watts put it. It just simply peoples. We don't come into this world. We grow out of this world. We are a part of all of it, and we can never escape it. And once you know this, once you get this, that you weren't placed in here from this spirit world any more than plums were, or apples, or cockroaches, or anything. We are all in this thing called the environment together.
heard me talk about what it means to be a no-limit person. But I want to try to put that into an entirely different perspective. There's a man who died just recently named Bucky Fuller, Buckminster Fuller. We served together on the council for the Hunger Project. He was a mathematician and a philosopher and an inventor and a really dynamic, exciting person, even at 90. I think he was 90 or 91 when he died. He was full of energy and excitement. And he said something that really touched me. He said that 99%, and he's a mathematician, all right? I'm not. 99% of who we are as human beings, you can't touch and you can't see and you can't feel and you can't smell. You can't get a hold of it. It's the part of us that is in, quote, non-form. And that we can only define as thought or mental imagery or visualization or feelings or, I mean, words that defy a formula because there's no form to them. And the rules are different in this part of our consciousness where we think, this thought process. And that constitutes, according to Fuller, a human being's 99% of their existence is inside. And we are obsessed, it almost seems, as human beings, with the 1%. The 1% that is in form. We spend most of our energy in the 1% looking at each other's packages. And this is something I give a lot of thought to. This whole notion that who we are, it's like, how do you perceive yourself? That's a real key question.
The problem is that a lot of people think that they are their packaging, all right? It's like if you went to the grocery store and went into the frozen food section and saw something that said a nice picture of broccoli with almonds on it, all right? And you take that home and you take the wrapping off and you put the wrapping in the microwave or in your little pot of hot water and you start boiling the wrapping. You say, well, that's not the stuff. That's just the wrapping, all right? The real stuff is inside. That's what's in there. It's the broccoli and the almonds are inside. You're just looking at the wrapping. That's the same analogy that I have with each one of us. We just think we're the wrapping and the packaging. And we get into this package and we believe that the package is more important than what the package contains. And what the package contains is your ability to be anything that you want to and to make almost anything happen that you want to. See, it sounds almost too far-fetched, too weird for people, because they don't want to believe that through the mind, which is what human beings are, that we can make things outside of us change through the way that we think. We don't want to accept that. They're formed, and they're going through it the way everybody else goes through. They just get in line, and so they get in their salesman formation, and they get up in the morning, and they go off, and they do things the way that the book tells them to do things. And then they come home, and then they're daddy formation. And then they're in another formation, whatever it is, all through their whole life. And they don't understand that there's something called transformation, which means to go beyond your form. What that capacity is, the intelligence that's behind it, is that anything that you can think, you can achieve. That a thought, a visualization, an image, is something that if you get it properly in your mind, and you start living with that image, you start living with that transformation, that eventually what you are imaging for yourself has to come about. It has to work out.
Now, how many have had this experience? And I want honest truth, show of hands, honest truth, okay? I don't care how old you are or how young you are. I want honest truth. How many have had this happen? You're in a dream. You're having a great dream. Great dream. Something from another dimension jolts you, wakes you up. A bell goes off, a door is slammed, a phone rings, whatever it may be, all right? And you sort of half wake up and come back into your form. You leave pure thought and all that great stuff that you can create. And you say to yourself, honest truth, I want to go right back to sleep. So I can find out how this dream comes out. How many? Come on, come on, come on. I knew it. Everybody does that. Now, either what I've got to say has some validity here tonight, or we got a room full of really raging neurotics. How do you explain what you just acknowledged? How do you explain that? You're doing this a third of your life. Come on, folks. How do you explain that? If I were to say to you, I'm writing a book. It's a great book. It's a novel. Great novel. I can't talk to you anymore. I want to get back to my typewriter so I can find out how it comes out. You'd say, who's writing the script? Who's doing it? I said, well, I am. It's my novel. Well, then, if you're writing it, you must know how it's going to come out. I mean, you must know, don't you? And I'd say, well, yeah, I guess I do know. I got it all outlined, and I know how it's going to come out. So now, when you're doing that, oh, I've got to go right back to sleep. I want to find out where that dream came out. It was so great. I was almost getting it. Almost. And you try to get back there. Who's writing the script if it's not you? Maybe you're not writing the script. Did it ever occur to you that you enter a new dimension which has different rules? No beginnings, no end, no cause, no effect, no time. In which you now are playing a new role. You enter a new dimension that's already been written. And you do it all the time. It's there for you. That wonderful dimension of thought. And that's only one. That's only one of potentially hundreds of dimensions that we can't even begin to comprehend because we're so stuck in what? Form. Did it ever occur to you that you are creating everything you need for this dream? And that when you leave your form, finally, this time around, when you leave it, don't you know that you're going to look back? And you're going to see that all of the attachments that you have to all of the things are just as much of an illusion as the knife that the guy had in your other dream. You're going to react to it, and it's real, while you're experiencing it. But when you look at it from a transformed point of view, it doesn't exist. So you created everything you need for this dream, too. But you can't buy that because it's just too real. I mean, it's just because you're not awakened yet. And when you're awakened, you realize that it's all a dream and that you are something else. And so all of the roles that you play, you're just sort of like me. You're a rent-a-Wayne Dyer. You're a rent-a-Marjorie. You're a rent-a-Sally. You're a rent-a-George. And you have a lot of roles that you play. And you just play these roles. But when you get through the gate and get transformed, you know what's so great? You realize that those are just roles. Those are just illusions. And so it doesn't mean that you don't enjoy them. Why would you not enjoy your dream? You're creating it. But what you do is, if your dream isn't satisfying or fulfilling you, then you change to make it do that. And all you have to do is change your thought, because that's all you are. And so you watch yourself, and you're like an actor. You're going through the motions. You play in the game. And you say, geez, that was a funny thing I did this morning. I was really stupid. I don't think I'm going to do that anymore. And I walked over here, and I went through a red light, and I don't know, that's part of the dream. And I did that, and I got a ticket, and I got to go to court. That's part of it. And you stand back, and you watch yourself do all of these things, knowing that your divineness is beyond that. It's beyond that. That this is who you really are. When you get that, then the rest of the dream becomes whatever you want it to be. Anything you want, you create now for the dream. And you do that through thought. Visualization, imagery, whatever you want to call it. And that is what you are. You're not this stuff over here. This stuff is all disintegrating.
There's an affirmation in the Course in Miracles that says, I can choose peace rather than this. I can choose peace rather than this. At any given moment. Now remember, peace is what enlightenment is. Enlightenment means to be surrounded by and immersed in peace at all moments in your life. The higher part of you only wants you to be at peace. So the part of you that needs to be at peace, that wants to be at peace, very often is overcome and dominated by the part of you that believes that you're separate and that you're special and that you're important and that who you are is this physical body that you showed up in. So what I'd like to do here is just have you imagine that you're in a room. And in this room, you're with your back to a wall, and you're looking out at this empty room. And everything to your right represents that which you notice. That's what you perceive, that which what you see in the physical world. Everything over here on the right-hand side represents the physical world with all of its boundaries, with all of the stuff that you would like to be able to manifest in the world, and all that you have manifested, including your bank account, including your body, including your children, including all of your friends, your automobiles, your clothes. Everything that you can see in the physical world is over here on the right-hand side of the room. And then I'd like you to visualize or imagine on the left-hand side of the room is everything that causes that which is on the right-hand side. The cause of everything on the right-hand side. The manifestation of anything into the physical world is the result of a divine idea. The left-hand side of the room represents divine ideas. How does something get into the physical world? It has a force, a God force of some kind in it. And it doesn't matter what you call this force, whether you call it soul or spirit or consciousness or God or Christ or Buddha, what doesn't make any difference, the label, the name that we place on this energy or this force, but it is in everything that is over here, and it is the cause of everything over on the right. Okay? I remember when I was a little boy and I was living out in Mount Clemens, Michigan, at this home, and this lady's name was Mrs. Scarf. And on the right-hand side of the driveway coming up, there was this great big patch of dirt, and she planted lilies of the valley. And they were so beautiful, these lilies of the valley. Every time I smell a lily of the valley today, I go back to Mount Clemens, to that home that I lived in with Mrs. Scar. And I remember even buying my wife a bottle of, I was in Kmart, I think it was, and they had a perfume called Lily of the Valley. And I brought it home, and I said, here, there's a present for you. And she looked, what in the world are you buying me this cheap flower water for? I said, it just reminds me of all of this. It's just such a wonderful aroma. So there's lilies of the valleys over here. And on the left-hand side of the driveway coming up was this great big patch of dirt. And every year we would plant tomato seeds in the springtime. And I remember Mrs. Scarf going out there with us, and she would have this great big pile of tomato seeds that I believe that she had dried from the year before. And she would take a sprinkler can full of water and a little digger. And we would go out and she would dig a little hole and she would pour some of the seeds in there. And then she would take the water and she would pour the water on top of them and cover it up. And she'd say to us, and I was maybe 4 years old, I would say to her, Where do the tomatoes come from? And she'd say, God will give us the tomatoes. Now, that was okay for everybody else that was living there, but for me, it's like I wanted to know a little bit more than that. I'd say, what do you mean God will give us the tomatoes? I'd say, are there tomatoes in those seeds or not? And she'd say, no, there's really no tomatoes in the seeds. I'd say, what's in the seed to give us the tomatoes? What's in there? How does a tomato come out of that? She'd say, she'd get real flustered, and she said, just watch. Just watch. You'll see. It'll happen. I said, yeah, but... And so I can remember stealing a few of the tomato seeds and putting them in my little blue jean pocket and going back behind this chicken coop that we had out there. And they had a little paring knife on the table there where they cleaned these chickens. I took the paring knife, and I can remember this like it was yesterday, cutting open the tomato seeds. Just like opening them up and looking in there for something like little tiny, I guess I was looking for miniature tomatoes, just something that would resemble a tomato. And all there was in there was this dust. It was just brown dust inside of that. And it was like I would just be flabbergasted that brown dust could produce these red tomatoes in just a matter of months. So the question is, what is it that causes these tomatoes? How do these tomatoes get manifested, if you will, into the physical world? And the answer to that is that there is a force that is invisible, that has no boundaries and no parameters and nothing that you can get a hold of, that is what we would call a future pull. It's tomato potential, if you will. Potentiality. All that's in there is a potentiality. And yet that potentiality that's in that seed that you can't see, when it is nurtured, becomes these tomatoes. So that the cause of tomato is not necessarily in tomato itself, but in a potentiality for tomato-ness. All right? To talk about it in those terms. Now, this happens to be true for everything that's in the physical domain, including you. At one time, each and every one of us was just a bunch of brown dust. Now, the interesting thing is, if you take that dust, that brown dust from the tomatoes, or that little speck of human protoplasm that collides with another that creates this little fetus that ultimately becomes you, if you take that dust and examine it under a microscope, you discover that it's just all kinds of tiny little what we call subatomic particles. First you get molecules, then you get atoms, then you get electrons and neutrons and croutons and whatever else is in there. And then ultimately you take those little protons and neutrons and croutons and you break them down further and you come up with these subatomic particles, and then you get a real strong electron microscope and you look at the subatomic particle under the microscope and you discover that there's nothing there. You keep breaking it down and breaking it down, and ultimately you just get a wave. You just get an energy. It's like it's spaces, and then you take the spaces away, take the particle, then you take that particle, and you look at it stronger, more magnification, take that away, take the spaces out, until you've taken all the spaces out, and that's all that's left is space. So that there is something called energy, or spaciness, or whatever you want to call it, this potentiality that is the source of everything in the physical domain. What I'm suggesting to you, as you imagine yourself with your back against this wall and thinking of everything over here on the right that is manifested and everything over here on the left that is the potential for manifesting, is that we have given up our ability. We have forfeited our ability to oscillate, to go back and forth between the world over here on the right, that is the physical world, and this world over here on the left, which is the cause of it. We think we can't get in here. And once we learn how to get into this world over here, which is the world of creation, and what are the mechanics of this, then we can put our attention, which is nothing more than that inner world, which has no boundaries to it, on what it is that we would like to see manifested, and we can co-create whatever it is we want to put our attention on. And it works. You become a co-creator with God rather than someone who is separate from God.
I tell people, supposing you went to sleep and you had a dream, and in your dream you had all these different characters, and you had all of this money, and you had everything that you wanted in your dream, and then you woke up, and then you look back at your dream, and you became attached to the stuff that you had in your dream. And you said, wait a minute, I want that. There was gold in there. There was silver. There was all of these friends. I had a Ferrari there. I mean, all of this. I got to have this. Somebody would come away and cart you off and put you in a rubber room and say, that was a dream. You can't be attached to that. That's just a thought that you have. That's the way you got to view life. Instead of it being an 8-hour dream, it's an 80-year dream or a 90-year dream. And at the end of the dream, you don't want to be looking back at all of the stuff that you wish you could still have, because you can't have it. You don't get any of that. So you try to detach yourself now, while you're here, while you're alive, from the need to have that stuff. Instead, you just let it sort of all flow. As absurd as it would be for you to be attached to the stuff that you had in your dream, it's that absurd for you to be attached to the stuff that you're having in this dream. You have to die while you're alive. Now, that's a very hard concept for people to get. But you have to experience your own death while you're alive. Let me tell you a story. It's a wonderful story. It's an old, ancient story. I'll paraphrase it. There was a hunter who lived in India, and he would go to Africa every 2 years, and he would bring back animals and prizes and things like that. Well, 1 year he took off, and he went to the jungle, and he discovered this large enclave inside the jungle, and it was filled with beautiful parrots, beautiful birds, multicolored, and they all talked, and he couldn't get over it. And he put a net out over one of the trees, and he captured one of the parrots, and he put the parrot in a cage, and he brought the parrot back to be with him in India as his pet, and he fed the parrot sunflower seeds, and he fed him rice, and he took wonderful care of him. He was very good. Kept him in the cage. 2 years went by, and he talked to the parrot every day. And he said to the parrot, "I'm now going back to Africa. Is there anything you would like me to say to your friends back there in the jungle when I'm back there?" The parrot said, "Yes. Tell them that I'm very happy in my cage. Tell them that I'm joyful and that I love being in my cage here with you. Just tell them that." The hunter went back to Africa. He went back to the place in the jungle where he had been 2 years before. And he told the story. He said, "Your friend that I took back has a message for you. And the message is that he is happy in his cage, that he is joyful with me, and that he has no regrets." At the instant of hearing that, a bird on one of the branches keeled over and dropped dead. Dropped dead. Stiff. The hunter assumed that he was just filled with sorrow at hearing of what had happened to his friend. So he went back to India, and he told his parrot what had happened. He said, "I went back and I did just as you said. And I told them all out there. And at the moment that I told it, apparently one of the parrots was so upset that he had missed you so much that he just dropped dead. And at the instant that that happened, the parrot in the cage keeled over dead. His legs went straight up in the air and he went stiff." The hunter was beside himself. He couldn't figure out how could this happen. And he took the dead parrot out of the cage, opened it up, and threw it out on the woodpile. The instant that the parrot landed on the woodpile, he flew up to the branch. And the hunter said, "You tricked me. What is this? I thought you were dead." And the parrot said, "My friend was sending me a message. He told me, by his actions, that in order for you to escape from your cage, you must die while you're alive." Okay, now that's an old story. That's an ancient story that's been told over the years. What does it mean? I mean, don't you see that this is a cage? That the whole planet is a cage? If you can just stand back far enough and see that we're still restricted by the limitations placed on us as human beings. We're stuck here, or maybe in our homes, or in wherever we are. We're all in cages. And even though we have more room to manipulate, we may even have a whole planet, we're still sort of in cages. Now, how do you escape from the cage that you're in? You have to die while you're alive. You have to literally experience your own death. All of us have to. All of us are going to die. So why not experience it in advance and see yourself out of your body, gone, but able to look back at what's going on now, just like the dream. Where you have the dream and you have everything you want, but you're able to look back at it. As you do that, you begin to see the folly, the absurdity of hanging on to anything, of being attached to anything, of needing anything, of telling yourself that I can't be happy if, from the perspective of having died, but being able to look back on it just like the dream. As soon as you can do that, as soon as you can experience yourself formless, dimensionless, form and all of the attendant things that you hang on to become irrelevant. They're not necessary any longer. You have a whole new way of living, a new way of being.
I think that we have to make a new agreement with reality, each and every one of us. A new agreement with what it is that's going to constitute our reality. And in the process of doing this, we have to let go. We have to let go of all of the things that we have been told and that we believe in. And these beliefs have served us along the path that we have found ourselves. And we have survived. But the beliefs, most of them that we have been handed, don't give us that real deep spiritual sense. And I really want you to look at those. It's like looking at a wake on a ship, on a boat. I was doing this the other day. I was down in Florida and went out on one of the canals, and my friend was driving, and I was looking at the wake. And the wake on a boat is the trail that we leave behind, isn't it, on the boat. Now, all of us, as we look at the wake on a boat, when it's moving along the water, all of us realize that the wake isn't driving the boat, is it? The wake doesn't drive the boat. The wake is just the trail that we have just experienced, and as we watch it, it just disappears. It just goes a little further, a little further, a little further, and then it's gone. Now, if you can see that metaphor, you can see that in looking at our own lives, there is also a wake that we leave. It is all of the experiences, it is all the people, it is all the events, it's everything that has ever come into our lives, all the beliefs, everything that we've been handed, everything that people have told us, all with good intentions, our parents, our religious training, our schools and all of that, not putting any of that down. It is not my purpose here to put anything down at all. But you have to understand that all of those things that constitute your history are not driving the ship called your life, unless you choose to believe that they are, any more than the wake drives the boat. I mean, what drives the boat? It's the present moment motoring that is going on somewhere in the boat, not the wake. So that hanging on to this idea that I have to be the way I've been because of what has happened to me is just as neurotic as believing that the wake drives the boat. We have to let go of that, and that is not an easy task. Becoming an enlightened spiritual master is not difficult at all. It is just overcoming the doubt that you have about your ability to do it. The toughest thing in the world to do is to convince somebody that they can be something that they haven't been before, or that they have an openness to a new reality. We get conditioned to believe that what we experience in our lives and this thing called waking consciousness, that this is reality. This is all there is. And letting go of that and seeing that that's just believing in the wake is the thing that you have to really work on. And you cannot do it. You can't do it unless you're willing to do it. No one else can make you do it. I can't convince you to do it. I can only say to you that what I said at the very beginning of Real Magic, when the student is ready, when the student is ready, the teachers will appear.
That story you heard about the wake is very relevant. The wake does not drive the ship. And what we're talking about here is how to achieve freedom, this heightened level of freedom, wherein you are not self-absorbed, by moving past all of the ideas that you have that convince you that the wake is driving your ship, the ship of your life. All of those things are nothing more than the trail that you've left behind. So what is important for us to do in order to achieve this state of higher awareness, to achieve this freedom that comes with higher awareness, is we have to really erase all of those items that are in the wake, because they do not drive the boat of your life. What drives the boat of your life is the present moment energy that you are generating. But you may be convincing yourself that what is driving your ship is all of the things that have happened to you in the past. The fact is that you just have to let go of your story. Everybody's got a story. But the truth is, if you don't have a story, then you don't have to fit it. And this is one of the great lessons that I've had from some of the great spiritual masters that I've encountered in my life through my reading and through my own personal experiences, is I have found that they don't have a story to fit. They have sort of let that go. And when you ask them about what they did when they were younger, when you ask them what influences they had in their life, they almost look at you in a quizzical kind of way, like, that's not really even relevant. I'm just where I am here today. And all of these things that happened back there are just the trail that I have left behind. So what we have to do in order to learn how to leave that trail behind is we have to discover who we are. When someone asked that of Khalil Gibran, the great Lebanese poet, he said something to the effect that I was rendered speechless when someone asked me the question, who are you? I could answer anything else, but I couldn't answer that question. And one of the ways to answer that question is not by identifying who you are so much as to look at who you are not. And what you do is you eliminate all the things that you're not, and then you deal with who you are, what is left over. A lot of people are looking for the how-tos. You know, how can I become a more spiritual person? Or how can I find my purpose? And they start with the way that they learn anything. Problem-solving logic. A plus B plus C plus D equals whatever it is, and you just go through the steps. It's not like that. When you consider that everything that you have done in your life has led you up until this moment that you have right now, and all of the things that you have assessed to be negative, all of the addictions perhaps that you've had, all of the problems you've had in your marriages, all the problems you've had with your children, all of the weight problems perhaps that you've had, all of the difficulties that have come your way, the financial concerns and the bankruptcies and all of the stuff that if you were to reach into your bag, you know, you could pull out this whole bag full of negative stuff. You get to a point that the Buddhists call Satori, S-A-T-O-R-I. Satori. It means instant enlightenment. Instant enlightenment. And the Buddhists believe, by and large, that enlightenment is something that happens in instants. It happens in moments. It's like I've talked about at some of my other tapes about going through the gate. You know, it's like on one side of the gate is the path that is strewn with thorns, right? And there's all of the stuff that I have just described. And then there's this gate ahead of you. And on the other side of the gate is this garden. And there's this flowers, and it's just magnificent. And there's happiness, and there's bliss, and there's fulfillment, and there's all of this wonderful stuff on the other side. But you can't get through the gate. And then comes the moment in your life when you go through the gate. You just go through. You know, the thorns that were there don't matter anymore. The obstacles are no longer obstacles. It's just and it's like, boom, instantaneously you are now on a different path altogether. I can tell you that for those of you who are struggling and trying to find a formula and trying to get it all into A, B, C, D, E, F, it isn't that way. First of all of the thorns and all of the obstacles that have been created in your life are there for a reason, even though that's a hard thing for us to accept. There's something to be learned from each one of those. And so instead of saying, how can I avoid these in the future, you reprocess your life in a different way and say, I created this for what reason? And I'm going through this because, and you fill in the blanks, or the lesson in this for me is, right, instead of why is this happening to me and isn't this awful and so on. And then Satori happens. And I mean, that was very revealing for me to read about this instant enlightenment, because every major change that I've made in my life, I mean, they don't seem like major, big changes, but the changes that I've made happened in instants. I mean, just in seconds. The process of enlightenment is really for most people, they think of it as getting more and more and more stuff. And so the more I get, the happier I'll be, and the more I have, and I'll work towards that. And so many people's lives are organized around this principle of getting stuff and collecting it, whether it's awards and trophies or positions in companies or whatever, or cars and refrigerators and bigger and nicer toys. That's the process of living in the Western world. The process of enlightenment is exactly the opposite. It's peeling things away. It's the process of letting go. There are very specific things that all of us can do if letting go is of value. It may not be. Again, you may not be. Where you are on your own path might be such that you want to get more. And you want to treasure more, and you want to hang on to more, and you want to hoard it, and you want to insure it, and you want to look at it, and you want to put it in your vault, and so on. And that's absolutely fine. There's nothing wrong with that, if that is working for you. But eventually, most souls get to a point where they realize that you come in with nothing, and you leave with nothing. You start to realize that the stuff doesn't give you fulfillment. It doesn't give you what you really, truly want in life. I mean, you can't caress your computer and your jewelry and even your trophies and even your positions in life. You start asking yourself, how do I let go? You begin to see that that you don't need nearly the stuff that you thought that you needed in order to be happy, to be fulfilled. And it gets easier and easier to do. But again, it's like, where are you on the path? If you're on the path where letting go and not being attached and not hanging on to all so many things and not chasing after, but just living, just arriving, just being, just enjoying, just being fulfilled in each day of your life, what you do is you find yourself less interested. It's not anything you have to force yourself into. It's not like saying, all right, I got six cars, I got to get rid of one. Right, which one do I get rid of, and how am I going to do this? And or I got to let go of some of these silk suits, or I've got. It's nothing like that. It doesn't fit neatly into the category of a list of things that you can do to let go. It is a gradual kind of new way of being, new way of living, new way of experiencing life, in which those things that were so dramatically important to you at an earlier time in your life become less and less and less significant. And instead of still hanging on to them, you become the person who says, I just don't have to do that any longer. To me, there are three specific stages of enlightenment. The first stage is learning by hindsight, if you will. It's like you're going through the suffering and... A woman talked to me just yesterday, and she said, after I gave a talk, she said, 10 years ago, my husband came home and left me. He just said, I'm leaving you, and he walked out. And she said, I was devastated. For years, I was devastated. I couldn't get over the fact. She said, now, I can look back on his leaving me as the most important turning point of my life. I see the blessing in it, now. But she had to go through 10 years or 8 years of suffering in order for her to come to the realization that his leaving her was a blessing, not anything but that. So that's like enlightenment through suffering or through a lot of hindsight, right? Not knowing that there's an opportunity in every obstacle. Then you get to the next stage. And the next stage is where, like, you begin to see and understand in your heart that everything that comes your way is a blessing. Every obstacle is an opportunity, and that's not just a hokey phrase of a self-help person, all right? This is self-realization. When you begin to realize yourself, when you begin to discover your magnificent potential, you see that everything that's coming at you has an opportunity in it, and it looks like an obstacle. So you're starting to say, I wonder why I created this. I wonder what's in this for me. And so what you do is you still may have the suffering, but it's very minimal, and it doesn't last. It doesn't take 8 years. We're talking 8 weeks, 8 days, 8 minutes maybe. So that you have reduced a lot of that suffering, because suffering is always played out in form as it comes from your thoughts, because what you think about expands. And so as this is happening to you, maybe you're going through a divorce, maybe you're going through a tough time financially, an illness or death in the family or whatever it is, you're looking at it now as, I can grow from this. I can get something out of this. I can transcend this. I can go past that. And when your mind is focused on that, instead of on, why is this happening to me, and isn't that awful, and someday I'll know why, but I don't know why today, and that's just so terrible and awful, and I'm going to be so depressed for 6 more years before... You don't go there anymore. That's just a place you don't go. You don't go back there. That's way back there in another time in your life. And you don't have to be a certain age to do this. You can learn this at any time in your life. So now you're looking, and your mind is focused on that. All right? So that's the second stage. And people ask, well, if that's the second stage, what else is there? I mean, but that's still not enlightenment, because there's still that quality of nature tyrannizing you, or the events tyrannizing you. The third stage of enlightenment is like when you get out in front of things, when you see them coming, and you play it all out in thought in that other dimension, and you decide which of these is going to be brought into form. So like you're out in front of it all. You're in a relationship. And my wife will say something to me. And I know that if I respond in a certain way, if I say this, then she's going to say that. And it's like, then if she's going to say that, then I'm going to say that. And then, and I can play that all out in thought. I'm out in front of this already, okay? This was at one time a guaranteed absolute blowout. Anger over nothing. Fear, perhaps, of intimacy. Who knows? Whatever. But it was guaranteed to be angry and PO'd for 2 or 3 days. Her and me. Maybe no talking, maybe storming out, maybe any number of things that people do over silly things, all right, to avoid being intimate, usually. So I play that all out, and I don't have to go there. I don't have to do that any longer. I don't have to make her wrong, which is a great step. I don't have to make me right, an even higher step. There's no right or wrong in it. And I play the whole thing out. And as I play the whole thing out, I decide... I don't have to bring this into form. I got out in front of it. It's gone. It's all been played out in my mind. Spend an hour or so each day, or today, or tomorrow for sure, no later, in awe, in total, complete awe. Be thankful for your liver, your hands, your brain, your invisible, incomprehensibly awesome mind. Be in awe of the very fact that you showed up here, particularly when you consider the mathematical odds against it. Just take a look at the functions of your body and the trillions of cells that all work together to make you function perfectly. This sense of awe is something to practice every day. The air you breathe, the water you take for granted, the food that grows from infinitesimally tiny little seeds to nourish you, the atmosphere, the ozone. Be thankful, be appreciative, and also feel a sense of responsibility to your universe. Treat all of life that is making this whole thing work on this tiny, fragile planet with reverence and awe. Know that it's all working purposefully. Just a few minutes a day in total awe will contribute to your spiritual awakening faster than any metaphysics course you could ever take. Enlightenment is simply the silent acceptance and appreciation for what is. So in this very moment, you can get into that state of mind by being thankful for the mind that you have and all the tools that you have just to listen to these words and to realize how magnificently they are all working. Be in awe and you'll be enlightened. Be enlightened and miracles will be your way of life. You have a lot to be grateful for. Keep it in mind as you shift from being a non-spiritual being who has no sense of connectedness to the universe to the magnificence that you truly are, and just appreciate it. Begin today affirming, I know I have the power within me to create a life of fulfillment and joy. I am a miracle, and therefore I am a creator of miracles. Truly becoming a spiritual being, having a human experience, rather than the other way around, that is, a human being having a spiritual experience, is really a primary message of these entire tapes. The contents of this tape series can be summarized in the simple words of a beautiful country man who traveled the country in the early 20th century speaking folk wisdom, a man I've admired all my life and loved to listen to his great stories. His name was Will Rogers. He reminded us all with these beautiful words. He said, "Live your life so that you wouldn't be ashamed to sell the family parrot to the town gossip." Now there's spiritual advice. This whole idea of freedom gives you a sense of peace, a sense of bliss, an absence of turmoil, if you will. It's really all about love. And when you experience this kind of love, the kind of love that is not self-absorbed love, when you're in that place, fabulous things begin to happen. An example of this for me several years ago is I was on Maui and I was to give a speech in Chicago. I was sort of grumbling about I had to get on this plane and why did I have to fly so long? I'm on vacation and I've got to go all the way there. And when I do get there, my publisher wants me to do all of these different interviews. So they've got me scheduled from morning until night. And then I've got to give this talk. And then I've got to turn around the next day and get on a plane and fly all the way back 10 hours. And I was going through all of this self-absorbed kinds of feeling sorry for myself, being a little bit angry, getting tense and tight and all of these kinds of things. And I got on the plane, and I did it because I had committed to doing it. And I was on the red eye, so I flew all night long, got there early in the morning. And my publicist called me from New York and said, "Here's your schedule. You speak in the afternoon, but at 9 o'clock you've got to do this show, and at 10 o'clock you've got this one, at 11 o'clock you've got an interview, and at 12 you've got these newspaper people coming." And there was just a whole list of these kinds of things that I had to do all day long. And I'd been flying all night and was filled with all of the reasons why I shouldn't have to do these kinds of things. Then I got an emergency phone call from my publicist down in Fort Lauderdale. And she said, "We just got a phone call from a woman who just found out that you're going to be in Chicago this afternoon. And her husband, his name is Fred, he's just had a liver transplant. And he's really not expected to live. And his last wish is that he could possibly have an audience with you just to talk to you for now, because a book that you wrote called You'll See It When You Believe It was so instrumental in him even taking the risk to have this operation. And he feels that you're one of the most important influences in his life." And I said, "Yeah, I'd be happy to do that." I said, "But I don't have a free moment." She said, "Well, the only time that's available to see him is between 11 and 12 o'clock. That's when the transplant unit is open at the University of Chicago Hospital." I said, "Well, I've got a live interview scheduled at that time, but I would love to do that, but I'm sorry, I just can't." So we hung up the phone, and I was going to call this man's wife and tell her that I was sorry. And then the other phone rang, and it was my publicist in New York, and they said, "Your 11 o'clock interview has been canceled. So you have a hole in your schedule from 11 to 12. And I thought, boy, that seems ironic, doesn't it? And so we got on the phone, and we made all the necessary arrangements, and I went over to the hospital, and I walked into the room, and he looked at me, and he said, "I knew you'd be here. I just absolutely knew you would." And his legs looked like tree trunks, and they were sort of green, and they just were so large, even down at the ankles was as large as a typical man's thighs. He was swollen so badly, and he had a bar that was suspended over his head. And he said, watch this. He said, "You're here." He said, "I know I can do this." And he reached up, and he pulled himself up on this bar, on this chin-up bar, and pulled himself the whole way up, oh, maybe 4 or 5 feet above the bed, and then put himself down. He said, "You see, I'm going to make it. I'm really going to make it." And his wife kind of looked at me and said, "Well, he thinks he is, but, you know, there's not much chance because the transplant isn't taking." And I had a wonderful visit with this man. His name is Fred, and we talked for about an hour or so, and I hugged him and told him that I sent him all of my prayers and love and so on. And I left, and I thought, gee, it was really a nice hour. I really felt good. And to remind me that I have to go where I'm sent. You go where you're sent, all right? And when you're free, you are unconcerned about what's in it for you or how it affects you. So it reminded me to stop thinking about my own pettiness of being a little bit fatigued or having to fly to Chicago or do these interviews, and to just be out there doing what I know I'm here for. It's what my mission is, which is to help and to serve and to promote these kinds of ideas. So I didn't think too much more about Fred. I wrote him a letter about a week later, and I didn't hear from him. And then about 2 years later, I was speaking in Chicago for one of the churches there. And we had a large audience, a couple of thousand people there. It was on a Friday evening. And this man came up to me at the intermission, and he said, "Wayne, it's Fred." And I looked at this man, and didn't look at all like the man that I had seen in the transplant unit. He said, "It's me." And he looked like the healthiest, most robust person that I had seen in a long, long time. And he said, "The liver transplant. Remember when you came to see me a couple of years ago?" He said, "It's me." And I almost fell off the stage. And I had him come up on stage and I had him talk. Here's just a few of the things that he said.
I thank my donor. I wouldn't be here without him, but I wouldn't have gotten to my donor without this gentleman. It's Friday. The reactions are real. The characters are illusions. Thank you for being my illusion.